that a certain distance from power is essential to the integrity of intellectual work. Second, an oppositional outlook helps. Neither Said, nor Foucault, nor Chomsky, nor Gramsci would be the intellectuals if their disposition was not critical.
That's Iqbal Ahmed, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Iqbal Ahmed on intellectuals, ideology, and the state. What role do intellectuals play in society? Are they apparatchiks, yes men and women? Or do they challenge the half-truths, mendacities, and fabrications of the rich and powerful? Noam Chomsky explored these themes in his famous essay, The Responsibility of Intellectuals, published in the New York Review of Books during the height of U.S. aggression in Indochina. Chomsky unambiguously declared, "It is the responsibility of intellectuals to speak the truth and expose lies." He called them the new mandarins, who are subservient to the ruling class and use their privileged position to advance their careers. They provide the cover for the crimes of state, articulating the underpinning and embedded ideology. For their services, they are well rewarded, with endowed chairs at the best universities, frequent media appearances, and fat book contracts. In this program, Iqbal Ahmed examines the work of intellectuals such as Chomsky, Antonio Gramsci, Edward Said, Rabindranath Tagore, and others, and the relationship of knowledge to power. Our guest today is Iqbal Ahmed of Pakistan. He was one of the Third World's most astute and innovative thinkers and anti-imperialists. He led an extraordinary life of engaged activism across continents, and was a mentor and a continuing influence on many. He taught at Hampshire College in Amherst. His articles and essays appeared in major international journals and magazines. He wrote a weekly column for Dawn, Pakistan's oldest English language newspaper. He spoke at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts on October 16, 1998. This was to be the last public talk he ever gave. He died in Islamabad, Pakistan in May 1999. And now, Iqbal Ahmed.
Mana has asked me to talk about the intellectuals, ideologies, and the state. The first major figure in writing about intellectuals and their responsibility is, of course, Julian Banda. Most of you are familiar with his La Trahison des Clercs, The Treason of Intellectuals. Writing in 1927, he argued about the risks of the intellectual's subservience to ideology. He was important also for identifying nationalism as the multipurpose ideology and one that would mobilize as well for war as for imperialism, for capitalism no less than fascism, for liberalism no less than racism. Mobilized national passions, he argued, devastate social life, suck even remote villages into the ravages of war, so that war is no longer a conflict between armies. They become conflict between peoples. The contemporary intellectual subserves, he complained, national passion to objective realities. Our century, Benda argued, is a century of intellectual organization, of political hatred. The Clercs, which was his word for the intellectual, betray the trust twofold. They exalt the particular at the expense of the universal. Instead of leading the ideological mob, they would follow it, sanctify it, give ideology, give the mob's action an intellectual gloss. Banda's solution was to confine the intellectual to a life of mind. My kingdom is not of this world. I'm quoting him. He sought an elite, spiritual, reflective, and distant from society and its passions. I am attracted to a part of him, the part that underlines the necessity to question power and to question mobilizing ideas. I do not share his next step, which is to visualize the ivory tower from which the intellectual doesn't move. So it takes me naturally to the next person, Antonio Gramsci. Gramsci was writing about the same time as Banda. Most of his writing, large part of it, was done in prison, fascist prisons. He viewed the intellectual, in contrast to Banda, as very much of this world, playing varying roles in society and exercising the freedom of choice, albeit the choice will entail both risk and rewards. But you are free to choose, at least, what role you play. But you belong here, and you got to choose. He saw these roles as falling into two categories of traditional and organic intellectuals. I'm, of course, making it crude, simplifying the matter for the purposes of an argument. Those who take traditional roles, for example, teachers, priests, bureaucrats, and those who are engaged with society in a more fluid fashion, the advertiser, the media man, the corporate designer, the party workers, the social activist, or the activist scholar. He saw intellectuals as pivotal in the making and running of modern society. No modern society, he argued, can be run without the intellectual. It just can't function. No revolution has occurred without them, he argued, and no counter-revolution has proceeded without them. Hence, the choices they make becomes crucial to society, its present and its future. He has had a strong influence on me. A host of his scholars, of whom I will name three most prominent ones, have followed on the footsteps, partially or fully, and advanced the argument of Banda and Gramsci. I will mention three clear ones, one of whom is actually here, Noam Chomsky, Michel Foucault, Edward Said, and Noam Chomsky. Built on this legacy, which, as you can see earlier, part conservative and part revolutionary. Banda is conservative. Antonio Gramsci is revolutionary. And these three are building on that legacy. I shall not attempt to summarize their perspectives, except to underline the absolute salient features. Foucault has excavated in great detail and with great success, with great finesse, the relationship of knowledge to power. Said has been most revealing in dissecting how this relationship transformed the civilizational outlook, or transforms civilizational outlook when it developed in the context of a vast imperial enterprise. That was the function both of his seminal Orientalism and later Culture and Imperialism. And Chomsky has been hammering almost tirelessly at how we are trapped in our time in a triangle of the corporation, the state, and the media, which is controlled, he views, by the power of the media and the ideology of the state. Who then are the intellectuals? Let us begin with a simple definition. These are people who are in the business of working with their minds. They accumulate and use knowledge, record it, comment on events, formulate ideas, shape images, and transmit these to audiences, large or small. What distinguishes various levels of civilization throughout history, has distinguished various levels of civilization, their literary or artistic achievement, their economic prosperity or moral outlook, is the extent and manner in which the resources of the mind are put to use. This being a profoundly complex and controversial subject, I shall discuss with you tonight only one aspect which is relevant, hopefully, to our discussion. And it has to do with the notion, by no means uncontested, that it is the intellectual's responsibility to affirm the good and just, and resist the bad and unjust. We have often done the reverse, but I am defining responsibility in that simple sense. What Banda called to serve the gospel and not the army's rules. The argument envisages a permanent symbiosis then of opposites, of choices, between affirmation and resistance, distance and immersion in intellectual life. When intellectuals lose sight of these choices, of the symbiosis, intellect begins to stagnate. Creativity suffers, and people lose hope and faith in the future. The interplay of these opposites of affirmation and resistance is the essence, I think, of lasting art, a motor of creativity, and the soul, in many ways, of aesthetics. It alone rescues history and liberates collective memory from authoritatively told lies. There are a lot of liars, especially in this neighborhood. And deceptions of power, of which too you have a lot. And it is thus that the writer and the artist leaves timeless and universal monuments to their time, which no historian can match. Think, for example, of Goya's paintings of the Spanish resistance to Napoleon's conquest, or the pitiless faces in Franz Hals' painting of the trustees of the almshouse, in which he has spent his harsh Dutch winters. Or recall Picasso's Guernica, or the poems of Neruda, of Faiz Ahmad Faiz, of Nazim Hikmet, or Adonis, or Mahmoud Darwish. These verities have been well argued by a lot of people. Every intellectual makes a rendezvous of sorts with history. But the question is, with which history? Noam Chomsky and Edward Said have made one set of rendezvous, and Henry Kissinger and Samuel Huntington have made another. And the choices are our own. I'll jump a little bit this argument for the sake of brevity and tell you that just what I have just done with you in 10 minutes or so, volumes have been written on this subject. What has not been done is what I would like to do briefly with you, namely, lives, actual lives lived, haven't been talked with the same amplitude. Edward Said, in his The Representation of Intellect, it's a short little book, his BBC lectures, and if you haven't read it, please do that. It's very, very good. In the outpouring of his studies about intellectuals, he writes, there have been far too much defining of the intellectual and not enough stock taken of the image, the signature, the actual intervention, the real performance, which constitute the lifeblood of every real intellectual. So what I would like to do is to take you with me for a brief time to meet some people who represent to me the kind of affirming resisting, the kind of organic intellectual that I consider to be the ideal. These people are, first, I.F. Stone, otherwise known as Izzy Stone, from America. Then I would like to pick up a South Asian poet, Rabindranath Tagore. Finally, I may just pick on a couple of friends. Each would convey, I hope, something of the grandeur and value of affirmation and resistance, the value of keeping a distance from power and of immersion in the human and the universal. I.F. Stone. Some of you may have seen, and if you haven't, I hope you will be shown that extraordinary documentary movie, 90 minutes, called IF Stones Weekly. When I was leaving Pakistan for the United States, my mother, who was still in India and did not want to leave, had written to me, and I am quoting from her letter. Quote, "In the West you will find two countries, one imperialist and the other anti-imperialist. Fight the one and make friends with the other and work with the other." I arrived in this country at Princeton to meet the frozen consensus of the Cold War. I could not find the other America. We lived in an environment in which my professors, kindly, warm, affectionate, generous, knowledgeable, perfectly good people, would happily write in their annual report that they were consultants with the CIA, or that they had given this many briefings to the Defense Department, and happily tolerated the fact that neither Marx, nor Engels, nor Lenin were taught at the universities. This was 1958. And then the first course I taught at Princeton University, believe it or not, was Politics 101. And its title given to me was Democracy and Totalitarianism. I exercised my personal judgment to add a subtitle to it, Winston Tastes Good as It Should. And my senior professors were not happy at this impudence of the young assistant professor. Then one day, quite accidentally, a friend of mine handed me this thing, this little sheet, and said, "Read it." I shoved it in my pocket, walked away, and then finally saw it a few hours later. It was a thing called IF Stones Weekly. I couldn't believe the damn thing. Izzy Stone was living in a time when lying was already institutionalized in the American government, no less than in the news organs of America. Both were lying freely, and all in the name of freedom. They lied about Korea. Now we know those lies, they have been exposed. They lied about Cuba. They lied about Iran. They lied about Guatemala. I'm only citing a few examples that are by now fully known. Stone, through his weekly, exposed the lies. He told the American people how Truman had lied about Greece, how Dulles was lying about Iran, how both had lied about Korea, how Kennedy had lied about Cuba. And by 1966-67, he was showing how everyone had lied about Vietnam. Stone was a remarkable journalist committed to truth. And for this crime of commitment. He lost jobs as a journalist. He was investigated by the McCarthyite Commission, Committee on House Committee on Un-American Activities Committee. Having lost all his jobs, he went to Washington. He borrowed some money. He sat in Washington and decided to tell the truth. From 1953 to 1975, there was one man in America who has told the truth. By 1964-65, the emergence of the anti-war movement in this country, books after books of his collections were being published by corporate publishers. And he was starting to receive great honors. Harvard gave him an honorary degree, and Amherst gave him an honorary degree. And the journalism people gave him the Bill Polk Award, or no, not Bill Polk, George Polk Award, and so on. He lived in virtual exile when I first met him in Washington, D.C. Esther, his wife, was his sole collaborator. Austerity was his style of life. He suffered from a permanent sense of outrage. Totally. He would meet me and say, "Iqbal, did you see? He lied again. These bastards, they never stop lying. I'm going to expose them." See the film. It is very good. He documented the secret war in Korea before the open war broke out. He documented the secret war in Greece before it had become news. He documented the massive secret war in Laos before the Senate held its hearing in 1964. He documented the CIA's overthrow of Mossadegh before the newspapers, before the New York Times was willing to admit to it, etc., etc., etc. He is the one historian of the Cold War that you can say, one journalist who told the truth. And God knows he took risks to do so. One wife, one himself, no one willing to give him interviews, no official willing to talk to him. What do you think he did? He bought 20 newspapers every day. He subscribed to the congressional records, and he perused them like a detective. And he culled out the truth from all kinds of sources. That was Isaiah Stone. He had a good life. Stone was not a Marxist. He was not a leftist. Despite the charges for which he was dismissed, he was a good old Jeffersonian liberal and a humanist. Ideology was important to him only as a guide to personal conduct, not as an instrument of mass mobilization or social repression.
You're listening to Iqbal Ahmed, Intellectuals, Ideology, and the State. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get CDs of this program and his book, Confronting Empire, by calling us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977.
What I want to tell you in brief now, Stone was central to the emergence of the radical movement in the 1960s, which opposed the American war in Vietnam. Stone was central to the emergence of Chomsky and Iqbal Ahmed and Howard Zinn as opponents of Walsh. I have paid a compliment just now to a master. I should also say one more thing about Stone. I know very few people who were as capable of overcoming ideological hang-ups or hang-up of belief. In 1942-43, Stone wrote a book entitled Underground to Palestine. Stone had traveled with the Jewish people escaping Nazi Holocaust and going to Palestine. And during this period, Stone had become a committed Zionist. In 1967, after the 67 war, Stone was the first American journalist to write that this was a war of Israeli aggression. And Stone was the first one to write that as it has developed in the last 20 years, Zionism has become a racialist, exclusionary ideology, and the Israeli state has become an exclusionary, racialist state. It must have taken Stone massive emotional courage to overcome and say that. And for this, he was pilloried all over this country for a long time to come. The man was fearless. Fear never interfered, or belief never interfered, with his desire to get to the truth. Let's move on to my part of the world, Rabindranath Tagore. Rabindranath Tagore was born in 1861, died in 1941. My parents knew him, and some of you might have seen in the profile that BBC did of me. We went to Tagore's city, Calcutta, and that's where the film begins, because it's my memory of Tagore. Tagore was an Indian patriot. He opposed colonial rule not because it was English, white, or Christian. He opposed it because it was discriminatory and upholding an ideology of difference, racism. In 1910, he was awarded. The British awarded him with knighthood, which he quietly accepted. And in 1913, he became the first Indian to receive the Nobel Prize for Literature. You will recall W.B. Yeats was one of the nominators. And in 1919, when the British forces committed the massacre of Jallianwala Bagh, he renounced his knighthood with a very bitter letter addressed to the British authorities. And he was honored massively as the great Indian saint, literary figure, Nobel laureate by the nationalist circles of India. But his glory faded as he came into an intellectual conflict with Mahatma Gandhi over the question of nationalism and Gandhi's non-cooperation movement. Tagore was very worried about the turn Indian nationalism was taking under Gandhi's leadership. And he felt that it would be very deeply injurious to India's future and to its multinational, multicultural, multi-religious nature. World War II, World War I, came as a turning point in Tagore's life. He You might recall, some of you, that Tagore was invited to the United States. On his way to the United States, he visited the battlefields of France. And he wrote from there of the awful calm of devastation, brought to my mind the vision of a huge demon, which had no shape, no meaning. He named the demon by the time he arrived here. During a lecture, first in New York, then Boston, then San Francisco, he started naming the demon nationalism. The European War of Nations, he wrote, was a war of retribution. The veil has been lifted, and in this frightful war, the West has stood face to face with its own creation. He had come west to lecture, and with expectations of raising money for Shantiniketan, the university he was then founding. His lectures about the evils of nationalism, the awesome mechanism of organizing power on the basis of difference, the mechanical organization of peoples in the pursuit of material aggrandizement. Hence it is aggressive and imperialist. The nation, he told his audiences, with all its paraphernalia of power and prosperity, its flags and pious hymns and national anthems, its blasphemous hymns in churches, and its literally mock thunders of its patriotic songs, is the greatest evil unto itself. Coming back from Europe, in America, he went to Japan and gave the same lecture. Then he arrived in India. And in India, he wrote to Gandhi, whom he called the great sentinel. He had great respect for Mahatma Gandhi, but he wrote to him warning that if this nationalism moves on, I'm quoting him, it will produce sectarian violence, intolerance, and other bad things. Nationalism is an idea that organizes emotions on differences, not universalities. It promotes the culture of majority and therefore will eventually alienate India's minorities and divide India. Writing in 1921. The burning of imported foreign goods will hit classes and communities unequally, and poor Muslims will suffer more than middle-class Hindus. 2, 3, 4 such letters. Then in July 1921, the two men met. They met in Tagore's house in Calcutta. A few excerpts from that conversation in 1921, July. Gandhi said, "But Gurudev means the great teacher, Gurudev, I have already achieved Hindu-Muslim unity," which was true at that moment. "I have already achieved Hindu-Muslim unity, Tagore. But when the British walk out or are driven out, what, Gandhiji, will happen to this unity?" Gandhi: "But Gurudev, my program of winning Swaraj is based on non-violence." Tagore: "Come, look over the edge of my veranda. Look down there and see what your so-called non-violent followers are up to. Do you think you can hold our violent nationalist emotions with your non-violent principles?" "No, you can't, Gandhi." At that particular moment, the Chitpur Road Bazaar, full of non-cooperators, followers of Gandhi were forcibly burning down the imported goods in the Muslim shops, Gandhiji did not imagine what this could mean in the future. Tagore did. Why am I quoting all this to you? This is a moment of conformity in India. This is a moment of nationalist power in India. This is a moment of ideological hegemony in India. Tagore thinks clear. This is the wrong moment. It will cause harm in the future. Speaks out. Between 1920 and 1947, Tagore's voice was drowned in the din of nationalist fervor. Now, he is being revived after a very, very long time. India has been partitioned. The partition has solved no problems. In fact, the two partition parts of India are now holding nuclear weapons in their possession and could blow each other up. It's pretty crazy. I know hour is getting late, so I'll cut myself a bit short and come to you with my last example, a very recent one which all of you remember and will share. Bosnia. A great genocide based on race and religion, fully publicized, has occurred in our time. At the same time, a second one has occurred in Rwanda. The most dramatic moment in this, or the most memorable time in this genocide, have been on the one hand the great rape camps of Bosnia, ignored by the world, and on the other hand, the symbol of Sarajevo, bombed day in and day out for 2.5 years, but hanging out with this notion of multi-religious, multicultural, universal statehood. In that one, I am tempted to cite to you the example of Oslobodenje. Oslobodenje was actually started as a newspaper during World War II. As an underground newspaper of the Yugoslav partisans who were fighting Yugoslavia's fascist occupiers. After the war, Oslobodenje developed into Bosnia's largest daily. As Yugoslavia broke up, it supported Bosnia as a multi-ethnic and secular country. Oslobodenje practiced what it preached. Its editor is a Muslim. Deputy editor is a very brave, incredibly brave Serb woman. As such, the newspaper and the staff became the targets, the favorite targets of the Serb nationalists. The paper was building was located in the death alley of Sarajevo. That's the little alley that faced the directly facing the Serb snipers in the hills. So many died. And Oslobodenje became the symbol of Sarajevo's resistance to this genocide. One day, here in Cambridge, I ran into Kamal Kurspaik, the editor of Oslobodenje, who was visiting here as a Nieman Fellow. And I said to him, this was 1993, I think, I said, Kamal, why don't you close the paper? Or at least move it out of that building. His answer, we can't. We can't, he said, in the most simple tone. We can't, he said, Oslobodenje is a lighthouse. I understood something there of what intellectual stands for. It's a lighthouse. The second example, also Bosnia. Somebody called me up in New York City, said, go to Pratt Institute. At Pratt Institute, students of Sarajevo University had put out an exhibition. Students like you had put out an exhibition. It was entitled Sarajevo, Past, Present, and Future. First, it was held in Paris, in New York, and then in New York at Pratt Institute. The students had reconstructed in photos, paintings, sketches, and narratives written down the destroyed city of Sarajevo as it once had been before the horror began. And secondly, in another room, they had reproduced in minute detail, street by ruined street, Sarajevo as destroyed by the Serb bombers and the snipers. So first, you saw the city as it was. Then you saw the city as it is. Then. And three, they had prepared in great detail plans in architectural drafts and papier-mâché models for rebuilding Sarajevo. Totally awesome. I asked the professor who had led this team, did they work on this for this exhibition? He said, smiling, they wanted to show the people the good, the bad, and the wonderful. What lessons do I draw about our role from these examples? First, that a certain distance from power is essential to the integrity of intellectual work. Second, that an oppositional outlook helps. Neither Said, nor Foucault, nor Chomsky, nor Gramsci, nor Tagore, nor Stone would be the intellectuals if their disposition was not critical. Third, ideologies, all ideologies, must be viewed suspiciously, cautiously, as spawning conformity. Four, consistency is important. Inconsistency of outlook and position exposes you to contrary and uses and misuses. Six, politics is central. You cannot avoid it and should not try to avoid it. And seven, risk is inevitable. You have to be willing to take risk. And finally, love of people is central. Thank you.
You were just listening to Iqbal Ahmed, Intellectuals, Ideology, and the State. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at MIT in 1998. Iqbal Ahmed of Pakistan was one of the third world's most astute and innovative thinkers and anti-imperialists. He led an extraordinary life of engaged activism across continents and was a mentor and influence on many. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, Arundhati Roy, Kianga Yamata Taylor, Tariq Ali, and Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. We also have a series of programs featuring Iqbal Ahmed, including his classic Terrorism, Theirs and Ours. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, Iqbal Ahmed, Intellectuals, Ideology, and the State, and for his book, Confronting Empire, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joichi is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Farid Ayaz and Abu Muhammad of Pakistan singing Kangana.
Ciao. Sagamam, 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 Sagamam.